AI is making waves in every field it touches. President Biden is now on TikTok, and the election draws closer each day. With so much going on in the world, it is hard to keep up with it all, let me tell you. Hi, I'm Kai Ryssdal, the co-host of Make Me Smart. It's a podcast from Marketplace. And every weekday, Kimberly Adams and I break down the latest in business and the economy with short daily episodes to make it easy for you to stay in the know. Listen to Make Me Smart wherever you get your podcasts.
Hi, I'm Lale Arakoglu, and welcome to Women Who Travel, a podcast from Condé Nast Traveler. This interview was recorded in the middle of November, when Kyiv was relatively quiet. But with the war being an evolving set of circumstances, things have since changed. For our last episode of the year, we're diving into something we're all doing a lot around the holiday season: partying. In turbulent times, parties can be a necessary vehicle for letting off steam, distraction, and finding joy. Something that's particularly true in Ukraine right now. Take the capital, Kyiv, where its rave culture, already established before the invasion, has become a surprising and vital part of city life in times of war. It's inevitably changed, and ravers have had to make compromises, but the scene remains as vibrant as ever.
You're on adrenaline all the time. And then you get to a point where that adrenaline inevitably drops, and now you have to live. But there's nothing left to live for because all the little things disappear, had disappeared during the first month of the war. So now you have to get them back and reinstate them and open some bars and open some restaurants and give those little joys back to people. I think in the party scene, you can see a lot of how the society develops. You can see the stagnation. You can see sometimes the boredom, but you can also see that driving force of youngsters and people who want change and are coming up with more and more out-of-the-box ideas of how to achieve that in their country.
I'm talking today to two guests, both who know the scene well. A journalist.
It is dark. It is very, very gritty. It is packed with people. Like, you feel people sweat as you pass by them. And there are women dressed in leather suits. There are men in 12-inch heels and butt cheeks out and looking, you know, amazing.
And a writer.
I mean, to party in the context of war, it's very much this feeling of friends and the feeling of strong spirit.
First, Anastasia Halushka, who reports from the front lines for newspapers like The Washington Post and The Independent. We first saw her work in the magazine Stranger's Guide. With her reporting schedule, there's not a lot of downtime for Anastasia. But she did find time to party in the name of research for us at a popular Kyiv venue.
I realized that I haven't been to a rave in a while. And K41, it's a famous club in Kyiv, was having its fourth year anniversary birthday party where they were inviting a bunch of, you know, artists, a bunch of DJs. And they are actually, the club is in an old warehouse, an old actually kind of factory slash warehouse that has been rebuilt internally. So I was there wasting my hours away and enjoying it very, very much.
Have you got any audio from that?
I do. Can I play it now?
Tell me a little bit about what it felt like, what it smelled like, what it sounded like. If it had changed since the last time you kind of went out to a rave in Kyiv.
So everything is accepted. Everyone is welcomed. And it was loud, noisy. You couldn't place the people around you. Everything was constantly moving. People were making out. People were, you know, there were these kind of walls that were like metal nets that people were pushing each other up against. There are a bunch of quiet rooms in that place. I still haven't discovered all of them, where people just talk, chat, make out, drink, do whatever. And then there's the main dance floor, which is, I couldn't give you the square meters, but it was incredibly big. When I was standing at the back, I could not see the DJ at the front. In the middle of the dance floor, there's a little, like, podia, little stages that are maybe 30 centimeters high that people would jump on and then start dancing, start undressing, start screaming. And it was like stepping into a zoo. It just kind of felt like Ukrainian society was going, it feels right now so contained and condensed in this war effort that once the okay is given for this kind of party, it just explodes to an even more extreme level. It's almost also kind of a defiance of, we're still here. A middle finger towards Moscow, towards Russia. My friend Dima, his stage name is Badworth, used to be a Russian speaker, a Ukrainian, but Russian speaking. Since the war started, he has switched completely. He despises his old music. He speaks Ukrainian now every day. Nobody pressured him. We're a very open, friendly, you know, group. But he just himself has gotten to a point like, I have to pick a side and I don't want to pick that side. You know, music playing during sets, they only pick Ukrainian songs now. It used to be Russian, and that doesn't get played anymore. That just gets, you know, and not even booed. It doesn't even get onto the stage because people don't allow it.
When you were describing what it's like to walk into that rave, and I think about the raves that I've gone to, and there's nothing that makes you feel more alive than being sort of in the crush of thousands of people dancing.
Yeah. Where have you been?
I went to university in Glasgow, which had a big rave scene. So there would be a lot of like massive warehouse parties. And then in New York, Bushwick, in Brooklyn, has like a big scene. But Glasgow was the place that I really like sort of discovered how to party. And I was watching this movie last night called Beats, which is set in Glasgow. It was made a few years ago and it's about the like 90s rave scene and the tension that was taking place in Glasgow at the time. And in the UK, where it was like the sort of the emergence of the UK rave scene and then the government trying to shut down illegal parties. And what you were saying about the choice of music and not playing Russian music also makes me think of the fact that these sorts of events can be political acts.
I actually had like a very long chat about this with Serhiy Leshchenko, who is the advisor of the president of Ukraine, of President Zelensky. He's 42 years old. He's a longtime raver, a very hardcore raver. It goes every time I go to a rave in Ukraine, he's there. I don't know how he manages it because there's a lot of raves all the time. And he's also very anti, you know, drugs and very anti-alcohol and supposedly always sober, but he's always there. Like these people are part of democratic development. The fact that they are organizing raves goes hand in hand with the democratic development of this country. It pushes and propels the democratic development forward because you cannot have raves in autocratic and like authoritarian countries.
You know, usually raves start at like midnight, but you've curfews to navigate. So like what time is it starting and when's it ending?
At 12, everyone has to be home. You cannot be out on the street. You cannot be on the way home. There's checkpoints, police stops and checks you, and curfew lifts at 5 in the morning. So what we do is we start a rave at 4 p.m. And it's a rave anyway in a factory that has everything walled up and you don't have any sunlight coming in. So doesn't matter. It feels like nighttime when you're there.
And I guess it's winter, so, you know, the days are shorter.
Yeah, definitely that as well. And then it stops at like 11 usually to give everyone time to clear, get out.
Looking at the news over the weekend, I noticed that there were drone strikes happening over and around Kiev. How much are you or your friends kind of like thinking about that or making any sort of risk assessment when you're going out to a rave?
Actually, while we were at the club, air raids did go off. And I think multiple times even. I have an app on my phone that jumps up. So whenever there's an air raid siren, it says it comes up immediately, like it makes a noise. Luke Skywalker's voice booms out of my phone and says that there's air raids and to please really, it's true. It's the actor's voice. And to please evacuate to a bunker or a basement. Honestly, I haven't been in a bunker. I don't even remember the last time, but it probably would have been somewhere at the front lines when I was working there. Obviously, afterwards, we heard the news that there were like drones flying in. But first of all, inside of the building, nobody heard it. Nobody really checked their phone. And I definitely haven't seen anyone responding to it in a way of like, oh my God, we should go to the shelter. The way that people think about it now is, well, if it hits us, we'll go out with a bang.
What was it like on the dance floor when people's apps went off?
People weren't looking at their phones, I'll tell you honestly. First of all, people don't pull out their phones on these kind of events because your cameras have stickers over them. You're not allowed to take photos, selfies, whatever. But in that moment as well, think about it. You're surrounded by hundreds of people raving to this insane music, letting go of energy that has been pent up in you for so long. People are not looking at their phones. They just couldn't care. And actually, I did have a conversation with a girl in the bathroom. We were kind of talking and she said at a certain point to me, it's so weird to be here when there's such horrible things happening. And I feel so sad, you know, about this war that is ravaging our country. But I also feel so relieved that I can come somewhere to try and forget, you know, what we're going through, what we're living through every day. But she was very worried about there's soldiers fighting on the front lines. And here I am, like a horrible person partying it up in Kyiv. And she couldn't let go of that thought.
Partying feels like, it feels like an indulgence, right? It feels like a selfish act.
It does. And I get her because I do have the same thing. And in that context, it seems overindulgent to have these kind of parties. And I will never take a point of view on that. If a military guy comes back from the front tomorrow and says, this is outrageous, this is horrible that you guys are doing this, I will not fight him on it. But then on the other hand, I do know, you know, of military commanders who have come back from defending the line in Bucha and Irpin that was north of Kyiv last year. And they came back to Kyiv and over the summer they were playing at K-41 or at Keller Club and they were playing as a DJ. So everyone has kind of their own vision on how to deal with it, with the stress.
Well, then I guess it's like you can't look at things it's so two-dimensionally, right?
Of course.
Like humans don't function that way. And do you think that there is an element of, you know, you said it's partying and going to raves as a tool for forgetting. But does it also feel like one for survival, at least when it comes to mental health?
Yeah, that was actually the next point I was going to make. It's survival. And I feel it now more than ever because it has become almost so animalistic.
Coming up, how raves in Ukraine are creating safe spaces that encourage mutual respect and tolerance, and are fostering a sense of community that goes well beyond that moment in the warehouse.
I'm Alex Schwartz.
I'm Nomi Fry.
I'm Vincent Cunningham, and this is Critics at Large, a New Yorker podcast for the culturally curious.
Each week, we're going to talk about a big idea that's showing up across the cultural landscape, and we'll trace it through all the mediums we love. Books, movies, television, music, art.
And I always want to talk about celebrity gossip, too.
Of course.
What are you guys excited to cover in the next few months?
There's a new translation of the Iliad that's coming out, Emily Wilson.
Oh.
Really excited to see whether I can read the Iliad again, whether I'm that literate. I mean, the jury is out.
I can't wait to hear Adam Driver go again in an Italian accent in Michael Mann's Ferrari.
He can't stop.
I mean, and bless him. I can't wait.
Molto bene.
Molto bene.
We hope you'll join us for new episodes each Thursday. Follow Critics at Large today, wherever you get podcasts.
You really don't want to miss this.
Don't.
Don't miss this.
Don't miss it.
See you soon.
Everyone's just so nice and relaxed and having a good time and getting rid of their pent-up energy. So it's nothing but good vibes. I was dancing with my fiance or just going wild. And I'm looking over and there's a gay couple with shirts gone, very, you know, extrovert. Like, I think someone had pink hair, someone had yellow hair. And they're making out passionately in the middle of this total chaos with smoke screens and lights and everything. And everyone around them is jumping. And they're just like having their little... These people do not get to even hold hands in a public space. They cannot. They will be beaten up, let alone kiss or hold each other.
In Ukraine today.
Yeah.
Yeah.
It's just not, unless it's a gay bar. I've talked to gay friends about this because I find that actually the most horrible thing, to go out to the store with your partner and not be able to just grab their hand. How absurd is it that people have to live that way? But here in that space, they're hugging each other. They're holding each other. They're kissing each other. They're living their best life and no one will tell them anything except for, oh my God, you're dressed so great. Like, you look so awesome tonight. That's the only kind of feedback they will be getting. This party last weekend where I was at K41, they are very tightly related to a certain brigade that's fighting at the front, and their entire winnings go to donating money for drones, for protection, for anything for that brigade. So when you come in, you have to pay an entrance fee, but the entrance fee is a free donation. And we actually know people, me and my friend group, we know people from that brigade. They will come to the club themselves sometimes when they're on leave because they know the owner so well and the owners are so helpful. A lot of bars and clubs and, you know, owners of establishments during the first days of the war just gathered all their manpower to just get work done to help the military. And they still continue that work to this day. So a lot of clubs are, you know, with all their winnings, they raise like donations, they buy stuff for the military because Ukraine still isn't on the same military level as Russia. Obviously, we need a lot more. So there's this Ukrainian organization called Repair Ukraine. What they do is when certain houses or certain places in Kyiv or around Kyiv in the vicinity have been bombed, they did this in Bucha, in Irpin, they did this in Chernihiv. They organize a sort of trip with a bunch of volunteers. They get to the place of impact, to the place that has been shelled. This can be a house, an apartment building, a warehouse, a farm, anything. They will set up speakers. They will set up a DJ booth. A DJ will play, you know, techno, all kinds of EDM, basically. And while the DJ is playing a set, all the volunteers are going through the rubble and cleaning it up. So they're getting all these, like, you know, leftover bricks or the roof that has fallen down. They just clean it all up, clean it out, get it into garbage bins, get it, like, moved off the property under, you know, the music. And, like, several DJs are invited to do it. They all donate their time. And obviously, they just can't do it in, like, East Ukraine. It's a very different setting. You cannot do it 20 kilometers from the front line. Another rocket might hit you while you're doing it.
Mm-hmm.
But yeah, here they're doing it a lot, and it's actually very great to see. It's amazing and inspiring.
Given that there has been such a level of destruction, have raves been moving into some of these spaces that have been damaged by bombing, or is that purely seen as something to be restored?
No, that would be in bad taste.
Yeah.
It sounds funny that I say it that way, but I haven't heard of it because it's one thing to, you know, do a cleaning rave where you help, you know, restore kind of or clean up a farm that has been hit. It's completely different to just like come into a destroyed house or, you know, a property that someone once owned that has been burned to the ground
and
just organize a party there. That's a very different, you know, ballpark.
That's really interesting. You described everyone as exhausted, and yet people are finding ways to be creative.
I know, people are way more... I sometimes look at it and I'm like, how do you do it? Like, I can't. But they do. I think it's because partially it's an outlet, right? At certain points, I think it gets so much that you need to get it out somewhere. But I think it also comes and goes in waves when there's... more, you know, there's certain emotions keeps building up and at a certain point has to get out. But then once it's out, I think it becomes harder to draw inspiration from, you know, everyday things. You kind of have to wait for that adrenaline to hit again. That's how I feel in my work.
Outside of the people who are going to the raves or are involved in rave culture in Ukraine, what's it sort of like in the wider community in Kyiv right now? How are people gathering and finding that sense of connection as we go into the second Christmas?
It's hard. I know for myself that I've become a lot more isolated, and I have a hard time, you know, being around. I used to be such a social butterfly, and now I'm just constantly socially and emotionally depleted. And I know that a lot of my friends feel the same way. And everyone's just like, we get it. Like nobody has the energy to reply or come out and meet up for drinks. It does still take place. It happens. It just happens at a much lower pace. People find their ways to bars and restaurants that are open, parties. You know, people hang out at homes with my girlfriends. I do a lot more sleepovers now because sometimes you're not finished talking by midnight. So you just stay the night and you find these little things that still bring you joy. Kyiv in winter is exceptionally hard because it's so cold. I mean, there's going to be snow covering the streets all over pretty soon. And as stupid as this sounds, because I said it last year and someone laughed at me and said, I can't believe that there's a war and this is what you're worried about. But the fact that these problems with electricity also persevere, we haven't had them turn off the lights yet, but if they will happen again this year, the way it did last year, there was not enough electricity. There were, you know, power outages, controlled power outages, but still you get electricity in shifts, which means there's no Christmas lights. There's no, you know, Christmas decoration. There was no Christmas tree or Christmas market. And it sounds funny that I'm worried about this when there's, you know, almost a genocide going on in my country. But at the same time, the winter does drag out long. And aside from us, being here in Kyiv, there's soldiers like in trenches that are freezing in minus 20 temperatures that are holding their positions just so we can be calm and like have a nice evening in Kyiv. And that's something that stays with you. It also carries, I think it passes on a feeling of guilt no matter what you do. As much as you can accept that internally, it's still always there. Like, I'm enjoying this because of them.
Someone is sacrificing something in order for me to be able to have this level of safety or comfort or sense of normality.
Yeah.
And I also imagine the Christmas lights, much like the raves, it's like a little glimmer of being human and what it is to feel joy.
Yeah, it definitely is. Because it's eventually the small things, right? As much as, you know, these raves or artwork or, you know, a violinist who's playing on the street. As much as those are all small things, they are kind of what make the day pass by and make it a pleasant experience. People are also just tired of living in fear. They're tired of constantly being afraid and constantly being worried. When you're surviving in the first months of the war, you are surviving. You are on adrenaline all the time. And then you get to a point where that adrenaline inevitably drops and now you have to live. But there's nothing left to live for because all the little things had disappeared during the first month of the war. So now you have to get them back and reinstate them and open some bars and open some restaurants and give those little joys back to people. And I think that's something that is being fought for right now, but it's never an easy discussion to have in a public sphere. It's always going to be criticized by people who feel that it's not appropriate.
In a minute, a novelist in Lviv who's incorporating rave culture into her new book.
We've all been there before. You're planning a dinner party or having family over or even just cooking for yourself when all of a sudden it starts to feel overwhelming.
I live in a very small one-bedroom apartment with a very small kitchen.
I can't figure out what to serve besides water soup at this point.
I'm Chris Morocco, food director of Bon Appetit and Epicurious, and this is Dinner SOS, a new podcast from Bon Appetit. Maybe it's a last-minute party with no menu inspiration, a kitchen with no space, a toddler who will only eat buttered pasta. Name your dinner emergency. We're here to help. Here's how the show works. On each episode, we'll take a call from a home cook facing a real dinner emergency. Then, I'll work with one of our editors or someone from our amazing test kitchen to try and solve it. Because cooking for the people you love should inspire joy without a side of stress. Make sure you're following Dinner SOS wherever you're listening now.
Poet and author Haska Shyam is talking to me from her hometown, Lviv, in Western Ukraine.
I try to make this mixture of family novel and historical novel. There is a mother and a daughter, and there are generational differences, but also generational unity. And also, I really try to show this, how much we were like dragged into this Russian context, like as an empire, as colonial empire, how we, like they try to have control all the time. Parties are not that much a central part of it, but it's important part of it.
Parties often get described as frivolous or an indulgence, but it seems they serve a greater purpose, right?
Yeah, I do think they serve a greater purpose because, I don't know, I mean, it's still like a lot about trust and feeling of community. Like when you think about so many people like having fun together, it's a lot about trust, like, you know, like to relax, you have to trust people around. And it's also this feeling of community and like, you know, not doing harm to the others and like respecting the way the others have fun. I mean, to party in the context of war, it's very much this feeling of strength and the feeling of strong spirit. In my next novel, I really try to describe this last decade of Ukraine, a bit of Lviv, a bit of Odessa, a bit of Kharkiv, but mainly Kyiv. Because for me, somehow, I understood that it was this Belle Epoque, this golden era. In the last 10 years, it was really super dynamic. The parties were really amazing, you know, like vibes. And there was also this quite interesting movement of kinky parties, like also like this, when the feeling that sex revolution finally came to us. I don't know, like what, 60 years later, 70 years later?
Because it was your 1960s.
There was this very like conscious moving of like, you know, sexual freedom, but also with all kind of consent and acceptance and body positive component in it. So it was really like basically shaping this new generation. And also somehow, like, I do think that free approach was something that actually detached us from post-Soviet and Russian context a lot.
How much do you think that was a conscious choice? Or was it happening organically and sort of claiming a modern Ukrainian identity?
I think it was more organic and kind of instinctive thing that was happening in a natural way. You're really right. I see it more in retrospective that that was really important and influential.
As far as you're willing to reveal, could you describe any of those parties?
I really remember the date because it was the last weekend before the lockdown in Kyiv. And it was, it's a very like famous and important collective from Berlin. It's called Perceptual. So these parties are like, basically you have to come there almost undressed, like all this kind of like, you know, black tape on the nipples thing. Like many people were like almost undressed, but no one felt threatened or like being harassed or unrespected. So there were some dark rooms, but it was not that much of like, you know, sex party.
It was more a space of liberation and freedom.
Yeah. And they really had this very conscious approach, as I said, to consent. For example, when people entered, they were to select the bracelet. It was like red, yellow, or green. So basically, if you're interested in any kind of interaction, it's green. If you like doubting, it's yellow. If you just like came to explore without any contact, it's red. there is a big festival called Strichka that is like happening every year. This year they had this festival, and they usually, like during the festivals, they always gather a lot of money for the army and buy things for the army. So it's like somehow it's even like the places where people have the most fun and they the most chill, it's still this conscious of war going on is still very present.
Whenever I go to these raves, I always make a point of trying to talk to the bartenders because they see it all. They see, like, you know, the aggression, the, you know, at every party there's this one asshole.
There is always that one asshole, always.
That's always that one asshole who's like at the bar trying to make a row, like, you know, hitting on girls, being absolutely just his most horrendous self. You just don't have that at these raves. I actually talked to a bartender, I think it was at a certain festival last summer, where I actually asked, like, so, you know, is it going? You know, you're probably having a busy night. And he was like, I love these nights because everyone's so friendly.
We're taking a break for the next couple weeks, and we'll be back on January 11th with a brand new episode. While we're away, we're revisiting one of my favourite episodes with best friends Nicole Byer and Sashir Zamata. We'll also be dropping into your feed an episode from the New Yorker's smash hit podcast, Critics at Large, about Britney Spears' new memoir. And we're working on an upcoming show about travelling for our obsessions. If you have a story you can share with us about a trip to experience something you are truly obsessive about, DM us on Instagram at Women Who Travel or shoot us an email at womenwhotravel@cntraveler.com. See you in the new year. I'm Lale Arakoglu, and you can find me on Instagram at Lale Hannah. Our engineers are Jake Loomis and Gabe Kuroga. The show's mixed by Amar Lal. Duke Kapfner from Corporation for Independent Media is our producer.
And if you are watching this video, either I'm dead or I'm in a very, very, very bad situation.
She said, oh my God, I can hear gunshots. I can hear men outside.
Where are they? What have they done to them? Are they dead? Are they not dead?
There is one suspect, her father, the Sheikh.
It's Madeline Barron from In the Dark. We've teamed up with our new colleague, Heidi Blake, at The New Yorker to try to answer a question about one of the richest men in the world, the ruler of Dubai.
Why do the women in Sheikh Mohammed's family keep trying to run away?
There's 5 policemen outside and 2 policewomen inside the house. So basically, I'm a hostage.
And he reminded me that Sheikh Mohammed can get me anywhere.
Because you're a rich and powerful person, you can effectively break any law you want in our country and get away with it.
The Runaway Princesses is available now. Follow In the Dark wherever you get your podcasts.